Welcome to World Policy on Air, a weekly podcast from the pages and website of World Policy Journal, published by the nonprofit World Policy Institute in New York. I'm David Alpern. In this week's program, posted November 4th, 2016, we focus on a new WPJ fall issue analysis of suppression, discrimination, and civil unrest in Ethiopia's Oromo region going back more than a century, leading to renewed bloodshed and a national state of emergency just last month. The story is headlined Ethiopia's Original Sin, the Oromo Tragedy. We'll also point out other top features in the new fall issue, cover theme History's Ghosts. But first, some top news from Washington this week. The U.S. presidential campaign continued to teeter and tighten after the much-criticized disclosure by FBI Director James Comey that hundreds of thousands of emails apparently linked to Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton's private server as Secretary of State had turned up in an unrelated sexting investigation of disgraced former Congressman Anthony Weiner. He's the estranged husband of longtime Clinton top aide Huma Abedin, whose lawyer said she had no idea how they got on Weiner's laptop. A rushed, computerized examination of the emails was launched by the Justice Department, but no official word was expected before Election Day on whether any of them contained classified material or signs of a cover-up or duplicated messages already known, which Comey previously declared not meriting Clinton's prosecution. Clinton supporters countered with ads painting GOP contender Donald Trump as too cavalier about the threat of nuclear proliferation and support for longtime U.S. allies, and with demands for official findings on charges Trump had questionable connections to Russia and President Vladimir Putin. But the FBI reportedly had found no evidence. Putin himself denied preferring the Republican, though he welcomed his statements that U.S.-Russian relations should be improved and called Trump's, quote, extravagant behavior, quote, a method to get through to people's hearts. The rising cost of Obamacare and Trump's vulgar comments and alleged behavior towards women also were key factors in the final days of campaign 2016. You're listening to World Policy on Air. Now this.
ማርያም ደሳለኝ ገልጸዋል።
የዚህ አስቸኳይ ጊዜ አዋጅ ያስፈልገበት ዋናው ምክንያት
The state of emergency declared by Ethiopia's prime minister on October 9th brought no sudden end to year-long anti-government protests that saw at least 500 killed, many of them on a single day earlier in the month. The violence has roots going back 120 years to the suppression of people in the Oromo region, at least a third of the nation's population, despite their key aid to Abyssinian Emperor Menelik II in turning back an invading Italian army at the Battle of Adwa to create the modern Ethiopian state. How that history has led to the current confrontation and what might be done to resolve it are the subjects of a prescient analysis in the new fall issue of World Policy Journal, cover theme History's Ghosts. Headlined Ethiopia's Original Sin, the Oromo Tragedy, the article was written by Hassan Hussein, assistant professor of history at St. Mary's University in Minnesota, and Mohamed Adimo, founding editor of the Oromo website opride.com, with whom I spoke recently for this podcast. Mohamed Adimo, welcome to World Policy on Air.
Thank you for having me, David.
Let's go back before the Battle of Adwa, and what you note were the many ways Menelik II was just as bad as the Italians in his colonial-style consolidation of power, most notably and bloodily against the Oromo in 1887.
Yes, absolutely. Menelik's invasion of the Oromo country, generally the independent nations in southern Ethiopia, you know, the Wolaita, the Sidama, the Kaffa, and others, whom that we did not have the space to mention in that piece, was just as bloody and as, you know, bad as the Italian or the European conquest of the Africa. But to speak directly to the battle in 1887, it is called Anole. It took place in the southeastern part of Ethiopia, in an area called the Arsi. The Arsi fought Menelik for 10 years between 1882 and 1892, according to University of Toronto historian Abbas Haji Ganamo. And that fought sort of took a decisive turn when Ras Dargue, Menelik's main man overseeing the fight with the RC, called a meeting at this place called Anole in 1887 in the Oromo, who value peace and reconciliation and have elaborate customs of conflict resolution, came expecting that this will be, you know, a conflict resolution event. And when they got there, the attendees were led through a narrow path where the genitals of the men were hacked off and the breasts were cut off from Oromo women who were at that day. And, you know, that marked a dark part of Ethiopia's history and also a turning point in the final conquest of the Oromo people in Ethiopia. And, you know, you talk to average Ethiopians who are Oromo, particularly the RC Oromo today, no other event in the history of that country will get people worked up like that event. And the story of what happened on that battle is told down to generations, you know, through songs and through oral traditions. And it is very much a big part of the challenge that we face as a country, I think, moving forward, because this bloody battle and the many battles before it were never properly acknowledged in Ethiopia's official historiography.
Ironically, you note the later battle against the Italians at Agwo was actually triggered by one of many self-protective deals Menelik made with European powers. Talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think during the scramble for Africa, when the Europeans decided to divide up the continent of Africa, Menelik made a pitch that, you know, Ethiopia for centuries before that remained an island of Christianity in the sea of pagans, and the pagans being the Oromos and other people in the south. And he also made his ambitions clear that he wanted to colonize all of Oromo country, and even as far as Khartoum, according to some literature. And as part of that, and you know, he also was relying on Europeans to buy guns and modern warfare using the resources that he just amassed from the conquered people of the south. So this particular treaty that you refer to is called the Uchale Treaty of Friendship and Peace, and I believe it took place in 1889. And one of the interesting things that happened at that treaty was that the Italians wrote two versions of the agreement. One is in Amharic, the official language of Ethiopia still, and even then during Menelik, the Amharic. And they talked about friendship, comedy, and all about peace between King Menelik on the one hand and the Italians on the other hand, two sovereign countries signing a deal, basically, don't touch my territory, I will not stand before your colonial adventures, you know, down in Somalia and in other parts of the East Africa at the time. And the irony of it, of course, is that the Italian version of that document talked completely about something different. And it made Ethiopia essentially a protectorate under Italy, and put Ethiopia under Italy's sphere of influence. And the controversy that really was generated when the Ethiopians, Menelik's people, found out that this was a treachery and the forgery that the Ethiopians, the Italians used. I think that in some ways was a trigger in the fact that they couldn't agree on the exact terms of that treaty is what really led to the Battle of Adwa, in which, of course, the Ethiopians trashed Menelik's forces and prevented, in some ways, Ethiopia's colonization in as much of, as it has happened in much of Africa.
after what Menelik had done to the Oromo earlier, how did he get them to fight with him, and what was their special role in the Battle of Adwa?
That's a great question. I think, at least in this feudal imperial sense we are speaking, the subjugated masses in the conquered land are essentially in the service of the emperor. Not only that you harvest the land and provide all the resources and you pay taxes, you pay other things, you serve the emperor. And the emperor obviously had access to firearms, and he had monopoly of arms. And he played, as we discussed, Europeans against each other, you know, telling the Brits that if they don't intervene, he would let them have parts of Sudan and what have you. I think, you know, when you are in the service of an emperor, and the whole country was in the service of the emperor, there's no question that he rallied the subject people of the south, including the Oromo, who were really superior in their fight and in their use of horse, and they knew how to engage in guerrilla warfare because they've just fought and stood in front of Menelik expansion for many years. So he rallied the subject people who were at that point in the service of the emperor and his empire.
Talk about what happened afterwards that led the Oromo to see Adwa differently than others inside Ethiopia and elsewhere in Africa. At least one Oromo hero was practically written out of history.
Absolutely. I think the name of this Oromo hero is Fitorari Gabayo Gora. In many Ethiopian history books, you don't even hear his Oromo last name. All you hear is Fitorari Gabayo. He died at the Battle of Adwa, and he's the person that rallied the Oromo, because one of the things I think Menelik and his successors did in subjugating the Oromo is they found within the Oromo people that they gave ceremonial powers to empower the few that they can use to subjugate the others. You know, they don't speak the same language, so you need someone who speaks the language of the masses. So Gabayo was completely erased in similar ways that the contribution of the Oromo was erased, not just from the Battle of Adwa, but in the formation of Ethiopia itself. Now, the Battle of Adwa was a unique feat. You know, the Ethiopians were not matched at all with the Italians in terms of their firepower, but they were able to defeat the Italians. But what happened afterward in the role of that battle, in Menelik's ability to use the subject people of the south to defeat the Italians, meant that he faced no external threat. So it paved the way for Menelik's focus in some ways to the south and continue to expand his empire. And you know, the south is resource rich, both in terms of wealth, in terms of land, in terms of human resources, and he needed all this as part of his capitalist expansion, but also to continue to buy guns from the Europeans. So in some ways, as I said earlier, the Battle of Adwa meant that Ethiopia avoided colonization. But from the Oromo perspective, from the perspective of other people in the south, it meant that Menelik had free rein and no threat from outside to continue to subjugate them and bring them under his sphere of influence. And again, you know, Adwa would not have been possible without the contribution of the Oromo and other people in the south, but their contributions and their blood, you know, as Gabayo Hood out there, their sweat, it went unrecorded in the history of that country. In the contemporary Ethiopian history, it plays such a role because for some Ethiopians, Menelik is a statesman, and he's credited for building the modernity of Beni State. And there are statues for him, but there are no statues for people like Frotorari Gabayo, who paid the ultimate sacrifice defending this country from the Italian invasion. And no mention whatsoever of just how important the contribution of the subject people is, more importantly, what the defeat of the Italians meant for the people, and what Menelik's conquest of the people in the South, the killings, meant for the conquered people of the South.
And the entire Oromo population subsequently suffered as well under Menelik. I mean, it was quite brutal.
It really was, and I think historians have made estimates that between 1860s and 1900 alone, the Oromo population was halved, primarily by the conquest, and as I mentioned, the RC fought for 10 years, the Tulama fought for many, many years, both RC and the Tulama are Oromo tribes, and there were other battles in the Afrancano area called Chalanco, very bloody. Through this, and also there was a famine that took place at the time, and people were displaced by the war, the estimate the historians make during this time is about 5 million Oromos were killed between the conquest and the war, and also the famine that ravaged the country. So it was bloody, brutal, largely unacknowledged.
In part, you write, the Oromo, despite their still significant numbers, were marginalized by a developing ideal of, quote, Ethiopian exceptionalism. Define that and what it meant in practice.
Ethiopian exceptionalism is this idea that when you think of Ethiopia, you think of the Amhara. Menelik was an Amhara king. Amhara is the Abyssinian king, dominant Abyssinian ethnic group in Ethiopia that traced their ancestry to King Solomon of Israel. And, you know, you think of Ethiopian food, everything that you see in the diaspora or in the country, and everything that gets passed on as Ethiopian culture at international events, at the Olympics and anywhere you go, is really an Amhara manifestation in the language of the country, despite the fact that the Amharas are only about 20% of the country. The language, Amharic language, is imposed on all other people of the country. So Ethiopian exceptionalism is built around making everything Ethiopian and Amhara. That also meant that the erasure and the exclusion of the Oromo and other ethnic groups in the country. So Ethiopian exceptionalism continues till today, where the Oromo, for example, despite being numerical majority, are still relegated to the periphery, in the center-periphery contention, the center being the power elites in Addis Ababa, in the periphery, the people who have been systematically marginalized, continues to dominate the debate about the future of Ethiopia, and I think the protests that we've seen in the past year is a manifestation of essentially that systemic marginalization that has been going on for over a century now.
Discrimination against the Oromo persists even among growing communities of Ethiopians abroad, you write, even in Washington, D.C., now home to the largest of those communities outside Africa, including yourself. And the key is a concept called Habesha, which confounds usual perceptions of black and white. Explain its origin and its current importance.
The term Habesha, the origin of it, some people, it's just not clear, but some historians suggest that it has roots in the Arabic language, where during the expansion of the Abyssinian Empire, which reached parts of Yemen, the Yemenis or people in that part of Arabia called the Abyssinians Habesh, and its origins goes back there. But what it means for Ethiopians, or what it came to mean in contemporary Ethiopian history, is that Habesha is basically a term for the Amhara, the dominant rulers of Ethiopia, and the Tigray, the current rulers of Ethiopia in the Tigrayan language-speaking people who also live in parts of Eritrea. So the Habesha moniker essentially excludes really 90% of the country, if you will, and much of the south. But it is used in the diaspora, for example, as a way to say that the Habesha people are different from both blacks and whites. And this goes back to Menelik in one way or another, because Menelik was on the record, Haile Selassie, the king after Menelik, or the last king of Ethiopia, was also on the record saying that they did not consider themselves black, and they considered themselves Caucasian in the case of Menelik. So the term Habesha in the diaspora is used in the sense that the Ethiopians the people who identify as Habesha like to think of themselves as different from the African Americans and other African immigrants in the diaspora, and they trace, as I said earlier, their origins back to King Solomon. So it's almost a separate racial category in the way it is used in the diaspora. The way it is used to discriminate against the Oromo in others, it's almost like a blanket reference that is often used to avoid talking about the difficult history of Ethiopia, which we refer to in the piece as contested terrain. Everything about Ethiopian history is contested because these historical wrongs were never acknowledged. So you use the Habesha to avoid talking about that. And then you say we are all Habesha. And what we are saying is we're not Habesha. And I live in Washington, D.C., and I go to grocery stores to buy, you know, spices and food from home, and I, you know, the taxis and the parking garages are all run by Ethiopians in the Washington area, if you've ever been here. And they ask you, are you Habesha? And sometimes you just want to say no. And that offends them because they become uncomfortable and they don't want to talk about it, but they look at you as if you're not seeking community with them. And sometimes you just say yes and you want to go about your day because, you know, you run into a 70-year-old person who's from, you know, Ethiopia, and they don't necessarily understand the nuances, and they are uneducated, and they are reaching out to you because you look like them, and they want to belong, and they want to relate, and sometimes, you know, they yearn for that because they don't necessarily connect with the American way of life, way of being, in the way that the younger generation does. So in those instances, you just want to say yes and give them a peace of mind so that they don't get uncomfortable by this. And, you know, also these interactions are often very brief in that you can't sit down and have conversations about history and the origins of the term and the way it is used. So it's a very delicate dance, and you look at every specific case and try to respond accordingly. But it's always difficult.
Talk about the shift of power in Ethiopia in 1991 from the Amharic to the Tigray, who the new rulers are, what it did and didn't mean for the Oromo.
So the Amhara dominated Ethiopia's power and economy from the time of long before Menelik, until the end of the Derg regime, the communist regime in 1991. And the demise of the communist regime was brought about through a coalition of nationalist parties, and one of them being the Tigray People's Liberation Front, the power, the people who are in power right now, the kingmakers in Ethiopia today, if you will. In the second group that was fighting against the Derg regime was the Eritrean People's Liberation Front, which ultimately became Eritrea and declared their independence. And the other group, the third and probably most important group, was the Oromo Liberation Front, which represented the Oromo people in the fight against the regime of Mengistu Haile Mariam or the Derg. So in 1991, these three forces and others came together with the help of Americans and others. They drafted a transitional charter for the future of Ethiopia. And as part of that, Eritrea declared it its independence. And the referendum was held in 1993, I believe. But an election, when the election was held, the Tigrayan People Liberation Front, who had superior strength in terms of military, but also had the backing of Western powers, systematically built satellite organizations that did not represent the Oromo and others in ways that the Oromo Liberation and others representing various ethnic groups in the country represented the people. And so the Oromo Liberation Front withdrew, essentially facilitating withdrew from the election, essentially facilitating the stage for the Tigray People's Liberation Front to monopolize power and build the Ethiopia that we have now, which was, you know, in theory based on an ethnic federalist formula, which allowed the Oromo, the Amhara, the Somali, and other ethnic groups in the country to self-govern and elect their leaders. In the constitution of Ethiopia today has its roots in that charter I mentioned, which was a compromise. You have different liberation fronts that were fighting for independence of their piece of land. And the compromise was that instead of everyone getting their piece of land, let's come up with a compromise. And the ethnic federalist formula was the compromise solution. But once the Oromo Liberation Front withdrew, the Eritrean Liberation Front declared it its independence, the Tigrayans were left in a position to really decide what they to do with the country. And they wrote a beautiful constitution, but they refused to implement it. And the grievances have been growing in the Oromo and others. For example, the Ogaden, Gambela, the Afar, the Anuak, many other ethnic groups have been fighting against this regime, and it is systemic abuse of power, where on the one hand they swear by this very democratic constitution, but they trample over it and continue to oppress the people.
After years of isolated protests and ineffective guerrilla warfare against the nation's new rulers, the Oromo in November 2015 launched the ongoing campaign of civil disobedience that's led to so much bloodshed and now a state of emergency. The major precipitating cause was a government land grab, I gather. Talk about that and the government pushback that became an even greater grievance.
Yes, absolutely. I think this started initially in April of 2014, actually, to go back. And that was when the government in Addis Ababa unveiled what they called the Addis Ababa Master Plan. The Addis Ababa Master Plan essentially meant that the surrounding Oromo or towns and villages around Addis Ababa, the capital of Ethiopia, will come under the jurisdiction of the federal government. The goal was Ethiopia is seen as an ideal investment destination, and the goal was to give this land to foreign investors to build industrial towns similar to the kind of industrial complexes in the South Asia, in China, and in some other places. And, you know, the Oromos, who are original habitants of Addis Ababa, have been pushed out of the city. And this was once an Oromo land, and now you go to Addis Ababa, there are no threats of Oromo left. You know, there are no Oromo landmarks or street names or museums, nothing that reflects the Oromo in Addis Ababa. And, you know, when I was a student there, we would get surprised when we ran into people who spoke Afan Oromo. It was that foreign to the Oromo experience, linguistically and culturally. So the expansion of Addis Ababa, the contemporary expansion, meant that this cycle of uprooting the Oromo from their land and uprooting their culture will continue to the surrounding villages and towns. And the way it is expanded, it was envisioned, the city was supposed to expand 20 times its current size, which means that about 2 million Oromo farmers will be displaced in an area 20 times the city's current size, would eventually become an Oromo, if you will. So this was the trigger for the protest. And the government responded the only way they know, by arresting prominent Oromo leaders, activists, and killing hundreds of protesters. And this enraged people. In the sense that, you know, people have been protesting for years and opposing this government, but they said even our continued existence as people is now very much in question, because you removed from your land, your livelihood, what else you have left. So the killings led to more anger, and also the expansion of the protesters' demands, including greater rights and the implementation of the constitution, which gives, which provides for self-governance, and then also people wanted to elect their leaders. The government acknowledged that the grievances were legitimate and the people were not consulted. They withdrew the master plan in January of 2015. But by that time, the protesters were no longer talking about the master plan. They were talking about greater rights, about democratic rights, and they were saying, we are tired of being marginalized and continuing to be part of this system, which thrives on the back of the Oromo people, because the Oromo occupy a very fertile land, and much of the development is taking place on this land. But the Oromos are not benefiting from. The development is affecting only few people at the top and people who are connected to those who are on power. So the protesters' demand shifted, and now, as you've noted in your opening remarks, we're talking about more than 1,000 people have been killed in the past year. That is about 100 people every month. So now protesters are calling for regime change, and they're no longer calling for elections, and they don't have hope that this regime will bring about change, and no amount of reform short of the regime change will address their grievances. And the state of emergency shows that the government realizes that this is the most serious threat it has faced in its 25 years in power. And I would note that the current government in power is a one-party state, essentially. And they've had five elections, all of which the ruling party won by more than 90%. Most of the time, but 100% in the past election in May 2015.
It's interesting, you write, for a while some of the old Amhara leaders saw common ground with Oromo confronting the new rulers, but then called them an obstacle to their movement for democracy and civil rights. What was their argument and the Oromo defense?
It's interesting you ask that question, because I think everything that we talked about Adwa had to do with the Amhara ruling class and the Amhara ruling elite dominating the country and killing the Oromos and oppressing the Oromos. And the Amhara and the Oromo had very difficult relationships, and the government in power understands that. And I think the fact that they lasted 25 years itself has a lot to do with the ways they pitted these two groups against the other. So when they go to the Oromo, they would tell that the Amhara dominant class wants to come back to power. We allowed you to, you know, learn a new language. You can now practice in your culture. The context to that is the Oromo language was banned from use until 1991. It only became a written language after the transitional government. So they would go to the Oromo and tell them that the Amharas are coming back to bring back the old system, the old Abyssinian system, the old exclusionist Habasha system. And they will go to the Amhara and tell the Amhara that Oromos want to break away and form their own enclave in an independent country like Eritrea, something the Amharas have been fearful against. Now that is changing, and the Amharas have expressed solidarity with the Oromo protesters, and they are saying that the Oromos who are being killed are our brothers. And Oromos are also saying that the system in Ethiopia now, yes, it targets the Oromo. Yes, it has been, the Oromo oppression has been there for years. But right now, no one is spared. And the government is desperately trying to cling to power by oppressing everyone. And I think rallying everyone together is the only way to get rid of this oppressive system and build a country that everyone can live equally in peace and with harmony, with respect, and hopefully also in a country where some of the historical wrongs are properly acknowledged.
Well, let's continue on that line. You say to disentangle Ethiopia from the current conflict and the long history behind it requires more than redistribution of power and participation in politics in the economy, but actually arguing that the histories of the country's diverse peoples must be fundamentally reconceptualized. What does that mean, and how would it get started?
Much of Ethiopia's history was written by court historians, and it was written from an Amhara perspective. It doesn't include much of the things that we discussed today. And the perspective that I'm giving you, the Oromo perspective on Ethiopia's history, is a new thing. It's a reconstruction effort by Oromo scholars and some scholars from other nations as well. In going back to the notes by missionaries and books written by missionaries in the early days, reconstructing much of it. And that goes not just for the Oromo, but much of the country except for the Amhara, because Ethiopia is conceptualized as an Amharanized state. And the redistribution of power is not enough unless you acknowledge those historical wrongs and have some of these things reimagined. For example, if you're teaching young children in Ethiopia that the Oromo came from overseas and they are migrants and they're not indigenous to the land, that is very offensive, and that is not the best way you can build a country. It doesn't matter how many ministers are Oromo. So I think what we are getting at there is to reimagine the idea of Ethiopia, an Ethiopia where each and every ethnic group in the country can see themselves in, both in the history, in its manifestation, which includes what is Ethiopia's culture. We have to think about whose culture is worthy of being praised as Ethiopian culture, whose traditional clothing, whose coffee ceremonies are a national coffee ceremony. What is Ethiopia? Who is Ethiopian? These questions have to be answered in a way that there is some kind of consensus, in enough consultation with people, and really critically looking at Ethiopia's history. In some of this work has been done in the past 20 years because of the ethnic federalist structure, but it needs much deeper engagement, and I think that's the only way for the country to move forward, because you have the statue of Menelik in the center of Addis Ababa on a land that is very sacred and very important to the Oromo. And they pass by it and they look, they see a genocider there. And what do you do with symbols like that? And which symbols are national symbols? It is an exercise in really rethinking and acknowledging and validating people's histories and people's stories. And that's the only way I think we can truly move forward as a country. Otherwise, one ethnic group will come to power and they will just repeat the same mistakes, which is what has been happening in the past, where, you know, the Amharas dominated power, the Tigrayans came, they promised to give us democracy, but they repeated the same things because the kind of discussions that should take place to heal these historical wrongs did not take place, and there were no truths in the Reconciliation Commission. There is no proper acknowledgement of historical wrongs. So I think we need to engage in those kinds of exercises, as happened in many places, in post-apartheid South Africa, in Rwanda, in many places where traumatic historical events took place.
Mohamed Ademo, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mohamed Ademo is founding editor of the Washington-based Oromo website, opride.com, with Hassan Hussein, assistant professor of history at St. Mary's University in Minnesota. He wrote the article headlined Ethiopia's Original Sin, the Oromo Tragedy, for the new fall issue of World Policy Journal, cover theme History's Ghosts. After we spoke, continuing protests forced Ethiopia's prime minister to dismantle his government and form a new one, albeit through a major reshuffle of existing cabinet ministers, quickly approved by the House of People's Representatives, entirely controlled by his ruling party and its allies. Also featured in the new WPJ fall issue, History's Ghosts, you'll find articles on what lessons from history keep being forgotten, on silencing the echoes of Tiananmen, and on the painful legacy of Canada's residential Indian schools. And listen next week when our podcast will consider foreign policy fallout from the U.S. presidential election. World Policy on Air is a production of World Policy Journal at the nonprofit World Policy Institute in New York. Editor Christopher Shea, managing editor Yaffa Frederick, podcast producer Matthew DeMello. I'm David Alpern.